Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. I know that you were online today.
Yes.
And I know that you pointed out Mary H.K. Choi's tweet to me. Do you want to just generally sum up what Mary said?
Mary said a lot of things. I don't know which tweet you're specifically talking
about.
Well,
wasn't there one that said, like, there's two things that go on Twitter or social media. It's complaining or it's celebrating.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, shit. She called out our whole career. That's it.
That's my life.
It's
my
just
life
complaining?
Is, yep.
Or celebrating?
Yeah.
So here we are.
Well, okay. Well, that sort of segues very nicely into what I really want to talk about right now.
What's that?
My pants are ripped. And
how'd so you rip them?
I don't know. Well, I think it's just over time.
But do you think that they are too far down the line to be replaced?
Yo, yeah. I mean, I don't know how to sew. So here's where we are right now. It's one of those things I don't think that anybody will notice,
mm-hmm.
but like they're ripped in the crotch, and so I'm super self-conscious about it.
Well, hold on. Are you celebrating this or are you complaining about it? Let's just...
Right. We need to figure out which box we're going to put this in.
Right.
I would say, ladies, I'm celebrating. No, I'm
celebrating.
I would say I'm complaining. I have to go get new jeans.
It's not like ripped pants are out of style.
No, but nobody is walking around with like ripped crotch jeans. Yet, you're right. I'm a trailblazer. I'm a trendsetter.
That's right.
We're being progressive over here. Shouts to Flo.
Yeah.
I do want to say people usually walk around with ripped jeans in their knees. Mine is a little higher up. My rips.
So what's the plan?
The plan is to get new jeans. Maybe I can get sponsored.
You know what? I celebrate that.
Thank you for celebrating and complaining. We checked off both boxes.
So all right. The plan now.
Yeah, you want to do something more meaningful than
that. No. Go ahead. The plan now with your pants.
The plan now with my pants is
everybody... Do you keep wearing them?
No, I want to get new jeans.
No, okay. But if you don't get them today, what will you do? Stay indoors?
That does sound on brand for me, honestly. If it's not...
Just walk around with no pants?
Yeah. No, that's not me.
You're going to do shorts in the winter?
I bundle up to the max.
You're going to become that guy?
What?
The white guy in the winter who wears shorts?
No. Yeah. I need to like grow a ponytail first.
So pants update.
Pants
2019.
Update, yeah. Huge news.
Can that become a hashtag?
What? Pants update?
Pants update. Traveling pants.
Yeah. Oh, maybe. Yeah. The brotherhood of the traveling pants. Do you have any? Well, you can't. I can't fit in your jeans.
No, wait. I can't join in this mission.
No, I'm taller and skinnier than both you and Dan. You and Dan are like the same size. You guys can share things.
This is true.
I can't share anything.
So
I'm the freak of the family.
If you guys, you sound like Conan. If you guys out there know of a good pants connect.
Yeah, that pants plug.
Like. Isn't pants plug like sewing? That's like an AKA.
Does anybody have a seamstress that I can use?
Let Jeff know.
Yeah.
You should put this in the newsletter. This is what the people need. This is the information that you guys need.
Actually, it sort of is, because remember when I went on Twitter and I was like, hey, everybody out there, we need our TV hung up.
Yeah.
Somebody just do it for us. Bring a stud finder.
Yeah.
You know, bring a drill.
Right.
And hang up our TV.
We have the TV.
Yeah.
We have the mount.
And some guy...
You do the work.
And when I say some guy, I really do mean...
Skip from BK.
Skip from BK, who has listened to every episode of ours.
Shout out to him.
Was like, hey, idiots.
Mm-hmm.
Don't put this on Twitter.
Right.
Get a professional.
Do TaskRabbit.
Do TaskRabbit.
Or whatever, like a less professional.
Yeah, we're not sponsored by TaskRabbit, so... Right.
But
Job Horse or whatever.
Right.
And so I went on jobhorse.com, and we got a guy, and first of all, I said I'd never used...
Wouldn't it be Hobby Horse?
Oh, that's so good.
Right.
Damn it.
Yeah. Anyway, so you go on jobhorse.com.
Jobhorse.com makes it sound like I've never spoken English in my life.
Right. Jobhorse?
Jobhorse.com. .net.
So the guy comes over here. He does the job.
Sort of. Mostly.
Right. And he says, don't hang on the TV and
well,
whatever.
Also, there were two things he had to bring over. He only brought over one.
Do you think you can task rabbit a seamstress?
Hobby horse? Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
That's possible?
Well, probably.
All right.
Yeah, so anyway.
That's something I'm interested in.
Hobbyhorse.com?
Yes.
We're starting an app, guys.
And on the subject of groupthink, listen, we moved apartments. The last apartment we lived for 11 and a half years. We got to know our doorman very well. If we went downstairs to take a picture and the person who had come through did not have a friend or an associate who also came with them.
Right.
We could always ask one of our doormen who was always doing his job if they could leave their job and then take a picture on our phone. So in moving, we've lost that, and we're not going to travel 5 blocks to the other place.
Oh, that would actually be a really good idea.
To get Leo take a picture.
Yeah, people do love the old archway that we used to take pictures in.
Which has no meaning to me.
No.
And has no meaning to you.
No, I mean, like...
Are we just going to parade 5 blocks with John Legend?
First of all, that's a great idea. Imagine if we were just walking up Amsterdam.
But unlikely. So mm-hmm. what we're going to do, what I'd like to do, mm-hmm. what I want to do...
is get something for free.
If anybody out there has the hookup on a ring light
uh-huh.
on a stand, uh-huh. like one of those, you know, 5-foot, 6-foot stands
mm-hmm.
that we could tuck away somewhere and pull it out every time that we have to do a podcast, plug the iPhone in and take a picture that's well lit,
mm-hmm.
well, let us know.
Hey, guys.
No, for real. We're on the lookout for one of those ring lights. We want to know the best one, and we want to know if anyone wants to donate it to us so that we can promote your ring light or your friend's ring light or whatever it is.
Well, it is one of those things because we did see that our friend Raven
yeah.
was just like, hey, I want to buy...
a coffee machine.
A coffee maker, and then Lipton or whoever, Nestea or whatever, whatever company it was. I don't know. Hobby Horse.
Uh-huh.
They send it to her for free. She was right. like, I'm going to buy it. Yeah.
And they said, hey, we'll give it to you for free.
Well, maybe we should be like, hey, we want to buy a ring light.
All right. Ready?
Yeah.
I want to buy a ring light.
Yep. And then now we get it for free.
Right. Okay, good. Great. Okay. So let us know in the comments or hit us up, email us or message us. Get in touch with us and let's go about doing that. Before we get into this episode, I do want to shout out some friends of ours for various reasons. I want to send good energy and love to all three of these people. Very different reasons, but let's get into it. First of all, Freeway. Friend of the room. You guys know him from State Property and his own solo catalog and Rockefeller and just an amazing and wonderful light in this business. Freeway, who for the longest time has been looking for a kidney transplant. He's been on dialysis. He's been fighting through a lot of health issues, but was good enough to come on the podcast twice.
He rode up to our show at SOB's.
Yeah, to perform on stage with us, which was just mind-blowing. So we couldn't be happier that he made it through the surgery. He is on the road to recovery. Big shout out to Freeway.
Absolutely.
Secondly, I want to send all of our love and great energy and hope you guys will too, to another friend of the room, Carly Hustle.
Yes. Carly has also been on the podcast.
Yes.
Carly was recently diagnosed with breast cancer, which yeah. she's been talking about on her own podcast, Brutally Honest.
She discovered it in stage 2.
Yeah, right before Christmas.
So on the earlier end, but it doesn't make it any easier. So she has a fantastic attitude as she goes into this. She has shaved her head. She has continued to podcast. She has great humor and great perspective as much as anybody can.
She's one of those people who says, you know, when people say fuck cancer, she's like, fuck cancer. Like yeah. she has a, you know, if anybody wants to listen to her latest episode of her
please
podcast.
Please do. It's just a really important listen.
But it's also very her.
Very, very Carly perspective. And we're all rooting her on and rooting her through this. And we are going to be with her every step of the way, all the way to recovery. So shout out to our great friend, Carly Hustle. And lastly, we want to shout out another friend to the room.
Wow, so many friends of our room.
Rory Farrell,
been here. Yeah.
Who is very famous now for the Joe Budden podcast with Rory and Maul, he being Rory.
He's the white guy.
But at the Rock Nation brunch out there in Los Angeles during Grammy weekend, he did the wonderful and beautiful deed of proposing to his girlfriend, Sam. And after she was like, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit,
mm-hmm.
oh shit, oh shit,
mm-hmm.
you're serious, oh shit,
mm-hmm.
she said yes. So congratulations to both of them.
Congratulations to his fur-lined loafers.
Just sincere congratulations to a very, very awesome couple. And just, you know, it's beautiful that they chose to spend the rest of their lives together. And we're just really looking forward to what he has to say on the Joe Budden podcast.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting Sam on our podcast.
Yeah, that's what we need to do. We've gone through all the Joe Budden guys.
Yeah.
Now we need to get into the Rory girls. Jeff, today on the podcast.
Today on the podcast, we have our good friend, Jeff Weiss.
Yeah, a lot of people out there know him from the music website, Passion of the Weiss.
He's the Weiss in that part.
He is, POW. And some of you may know him from leading the boycott of LA Weekly, the longtime alt paper out there in Los Angeles, which went through an ownership change and was not about Los Angeles or Angelenos or anything having to do with the culture of LA. And Jeff Weiss has been at the heart of creating an alternative to the alternative.
Yeah, he's leading the revolution.
It's called...
He's the one that's there with, like, the...
the pitchforks?
The pitchforks in hand.
He is behind this new magazine called The Land Magazine, and it's a capital L.A. for Los Angeles.
For Rory.
And if you go to thelandmag.com, you can go check out their first issue. You can request an issue, which you can get for free. And you can also make donations and be part of this really dope and progressive and culturally important piece of art, which is also a publication. Thelandmag.com is where you can go, and you'll hear Jeff talk all about it today, as well as his come up, his roots in California, what LA means to him, finding Kendrick on the early end, finding O3 Greedo on the early end, interviewing Snoop on the eve of his getting a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Interviewing Boosie.
There's so much good conversation in this episode, and you guys are really going to love it. Jeff, when do you want to get into it?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. the White House Plumbers, a.k.a. Rich Gang.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. Gang 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 Bang, a.k.a. Jesus and Marrow and Ginger and Sigari and Sporty and Baby and Pop.
And I am Hannibal Moncrief. Of the Los Feliz Moncriefs.
It's your third favorite podcast to waste time with. It's The Real. Bra-ra-ra-ra-ra-ra-ra. Jeff, what's happening?
It's good, guys.
Everything is good. Thanks for having us over your crib.
Well, my pleasure. I'm glad to, not the Upper West Side, but no. It's good. This is, one day.
Yeah. This is like the Upper East Side of Los Angeles, geographically, not in like,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Totally. I'm not like walking like a Los Opso, though.
No, yeah. You know? One of the things when we last saw you down at South By that we were excited about was your boycott of the new LA Weekly.
Yeah.
It's been taken over by these horrible people, and it is a shell of what it used to be. And I just peeked in the corner, and I see there's a framed cover of an old LA Weekly there.
It's true, yeah.
Is that weird for you to have that there and know that it's like not the same thing anymore?
It was really hard for the first 6 months. And now it's just so bad. It's kind of like morphed into comedy. And it was like why we kind of, I think, wanted to do The Land, because I don't know, at a certain point, you can't really like complete, like, you know, it's like, I think about like backpack rap, right? Like it was really great at the beginning because you're like, okay, even though I liked like the Jiggy era or whatever, like it was nice to have an alternative to it. Like, you know, different sides of the coin, blah, blah, blah. But at a certain point, I think something becomes like a regressive kind of art form. Like you can't always be like in opposed to something. It's like you harden into conservatism. So I think for us, it was like, okay, well, the boycott was super important and effective. I mean, we basically, I don't know, for people that don't know, should I like basically break down the story of what happened?
Yeah.
Okay, so the short story is Nazis bad. Turns out.
Wow, way to really like, you know.
Short story.
Yeah.
I'd written for the LA Weekly for 10 years. I'd been a columnist in the print magazine for the last six, you know, like The Voice. It was kind of the standard bearer of like progressive liberal journalism politics in Los Angeles, founded in 78, you know, in the wake of obviously The Voice, and kind of came out of the underground paper tradition that really doesn't like, I feel blogs kind of had that for a while, but there's really nothing that kind of, I don't know, like I'm like a real print junkie, right? So I don't know how familiar you guys are with like the underground papers in the 60s, but like they were like really flourishing. They were everywhere. Like every city had a bunch of underground papers, like Weird Subversive, like the Crumb comics came out of that tradition. Yep. Like obviously LA Weekly, Matt Groening's Life is Hell strip started there, obviously became The Simpsons.
Yeah.
It was everything from that. Jonathan Gold, who honestly changed how people think about food, especially in Los Angeles, but probably in the whole world.
Sure.
And he had a big legendary NWA story. And like the same month that The Source did like California Rap Hits Nationwide, like Jonathan Gold did like this definitive NWA cover. You know, it leading up to like, even when I was there, there was a woman named Christine Pelisek who like, there was a serial killer in LA called The Grim Sleeper that was like terrorizing women in South Central. And her reporting was like really the thing that kind of like cracked the case open and eventually apprehended the man. So it had like this really long, venerable tradition. It had been bought in about 2007 by newspaper people who, like a mostly male conglomerate based out of Phoenix, and they used to run the New Times chain.
Yep.
They were a bunch of libertarian kind of dickhead assholes that had a terrible philosophy, but at the end of the day, they're newspaper people, and I'll take like somebody that knows the newspapers who might just be a miserly vulture capitalist over people that are basically Republican operatives. So what happened was this paper had been on the block. Instead of, honestly, what it sold for was like, it was low 1 million. Like, you can't find a condo in some parts of LA for the amount that it sold for. I mean, certainly not in New York. And if they had gone to the writers and, like, you know, really had like a community effort, I guarantee that someone could have picked it up and really, you know, ensured that it stayed kind of this jewel of the city. Instead, it just they sold it to basically the worst people on earth. Like, the leader was the guy who ran something called the Claremont Institute for a while, which was New York Review of Books, called Trump's Brains. Like, their whole like mission statement was like to infiltrate progressivism, you know, whatever they perceive that to be, and like basically fuck shit up for liberals, more or less. And so they bought it, immediately fired almost the entirety of the staff. They fired every single editor, looking for free contributors. They misspelled Angelenos. They're like, LA's not a real cultural capital like New York or San Francisco. They're like, we're trying to make it a cult, you know, just like crazy ass shit. And we're like, what are you talking about? Like,
right.
And you know, they were all from Orange County too, yeah. Which, you know, I don't know if you guys have spent any time in Orange County.
No, but I listened to No Doubt when I was in middle school.
You got everything.
Yeah.
If you listen to enough Sublime, like, yeah, like the gist of it, you know, even though they're Long Beach, but it's like, you know, it's like adjacent.
But and, you have this framed copy, and
my grandma actually gave that to me.
Is that right?
Yeah. It was the first big story I did. It was like, I think it was 08 or 09, and it was on the Jerkin movement. That's what that is.
So do you look at it now and think like, oh, those were good times? Or do you look at it now and think just of the gutted building and soul that has, you know, sort of...
Are we ruining your apartment?
I'll never look at that frame thing again, Eric. Yeah. What is wrong with you? Yeah. This podcast is over. Like a viral YouTube clip. Jeff Weiss walks out of his The Real Podcast. I'm in his own home. Yeah, I'm done. You know, how dare you ask me about my framed LA Weekly? Weekly? Yeah.
I just bought this print of Kanye and Jay-Z, and the picture means a lot to me, right? It's done by Clay Patrick McBride. It was in that XXL issue where Jay was on the cover in the Oval Office, right, as president of Def Jam.
Totally.
And he and Kanye are situated like JFK and RFK, and it's just a beautiful image. Yeah. I bought a print of it. I want to hang it in our new apartment. And I really did have this conflict inside of me where I was just like, well, is that me wishing for old Kanye?
Yeah.
And when I look at this, am I going to feel like, oh no, like MAGA hat and just this sort of empty head? Or is it just like, that was a time and that was a place and I want to remember that?
Yeah, I think that's what it's become. At first, it was like really difficult. When I would see like an LA Weekly around town, like it would be kind of one of those things where it's like almost like, you know, like sort of like when you have a breakup or something and then like everything reminds you of your ex.
Yeah.
You know, like I'm like, oh, you know, I see that artist. I'm like, oh, I remember doing that interview for LA Weekly or this. And, you know, like I did stuff for the Times. I did stuff for a bunch of other places. The LA Weekly always has a sentimentality to me because that was really the first time I ever really got like notoriety for my writing was like the second piece I ever wrote. Really, like professionally. It was on Soulja Boy. It was when Soulja Boy had first broke and it like got in the Best American Music Writing. And I was like really young. And I just like, that to me was like, I was like, oh, you can do this for, you know, I don't know, but for a living, because I don't know if that what that means anymore. But but like, you are good enough where like people, like Nelson George picked it out, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was like, oh, the guy, you know, like I know he's
the
a hip hop legend.
VH1?
Totally. But I was like, actually, I was like, who wrote CB4?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I was like, I was like, no, actually, he's a pioneering hip hop journalist. I'm like, yeah, I know, but he wrote CB4. I'm like, and honestly, and CB4 to me was like, that was the best journalism where I'm like, oh, I just want to be, you know, chasing Gusto around and like cracking code.
Yeah.
And so it was like, that was the second piece I ever wrote, was on Soulja Boy, like, you know, as a, it was like getting paid. And the first piece would like started a conflict, or they started a feud, a brief online feud with the band Deer Hunter. So it was really up to a
what?
Yeah, it was like very 2007. Like, long story, but I basically made a Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure joke that they did not find, they did not cotton to.
Who do you have a bigger feud with, Deer Hunter or Post Malone?
Me and Post, well, we swatched it now. Both me and Post Malone and Deer Hunter. I mean, I haven't talked to Deer Hunter in like a long time, but we made each other mixtapes.
Wow.
I'd like to think that I exposed UGK to
Are you
the
dating
Deer Hunter?
Deer Hunter?
Yeah. You heard it here first. It's the real.
Breaking!
Out of that sort of drive to bring awareness to what LA Weekly is in 2018, 2019, you've created a great alternative, so to speak.
Thanks.
In your own project, and that's The Land.
Thanks. Yeah. So basically what happened was, we kept on having these meetings, right? And the first thing was, okay, we have to let people know what is going on. Because what happened to the LA Weekly, and I think is like really important, is what was happening in everyone else's backyard. And in LA, it was particularly dire because the LA Times was basically getting looted and gutted by a bunch of vulture capitalists from Chicago.
Tooted and booted.
They were. One might say they were tooted and booted. Yeah.
What was the name of the conglomerate? They changed their name, right?
Tronk, they became.
Tronk.
And the guy Michael Farrow. So they were actually a profitable company, but this guy Michael Farrow was a total crook. And he had a contract where at the beginning of every year, and I think he still got paid this year, he got a $5 million balloon payment on January 1st before the year, like in advance of the consulting that he was going to do for Jesus. The year. You know what I mean? And they're laying off journalists and this asshole is taking $5 million. And, you know, my friend Tal from Chicago, he's writer, editor in Chicago. And he was like, wait, this Michael Farrow guy is bad news. And it was as bad as anyone could have expected. LAist got bought by a guy named Joe Ricketts, who owned Gothamist and he owned that whole network. And they like unionized and he's just like, fuck this, pulled the plug, deleted their archives. So they eventually restored it and ended up getting... you know, someone bought it and gave it to one of the local NPRs here. So it came back in and then the Weekly happened. So here, but also look what happened with alternative weeklies was happening in, you know, Atlanta's Creative Loafing is a shell of its former self. The Houston Press in Houston is a shell of its former self. The Village Voice obviously gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like that's insane, right? Like I don't know. Like the archives never really made it in earnest. You know, a lot of these publications, they never have. I mean, LA Weekly's archives don't go back more than 15 years. How much journalism and knowledge are we losing? And that's how we like define and understand our city. And like it does feel a little Orwellian, right? Because like there are no histories, you know, and there are obviously you can buy a bunch of books on it, but you know, and like we're talking about with the source, like that stuff is not online. That's like vital knowledge that people need to kind of have and preserve. And otherwise we're just going to be like, we're going to think that, you know, what happens today is the only time it ever happens. So anyways, basically we kept on having these meetings about the boycott. We shut down a few of their events because their whole thing was like they were trying to basically monetize off food events, like the legalized weed business that came in here. And we had to kind of like educate people and being like, look, this is a fucking grift. And like, obviously, you could see with the Trump administration, I mean, there's like a nationwide epidemic. And at one of these meetings, it just became evident where we're like, well, it started like, okay, LA Weekly did a people's issue every year. So like, let's do a people's issue for the people that we really think reflect like the true character and like spirit of the city. And then it became... fuck, well, why don't we just do like a real issue? And then I was like, does anyone know how to like make a magazine? Like a couple people kind of knew how to make a magazine. And like the cool thing about the boycott was, you know, we were talking a little about this a little before, but like often, you know, it's like corny to say out loud, but often like some of the darkest experiences of your life can bring you to kind of unlikely allies and people that you might not have known before. And it kind of instilled like fostered a kind of sense of community among LA journalists, at least in my like little corner of, you know, of it. And I met a lot of the people that I'm working with at The Land. We'd only known each other like via Twitter or like maybe I'd met them once like an LA Weekly party, like and talked for like 10 minutes, you know. And they're like all like really dedicated and talented people. And like, you know, people like a lot of writers like Molly Lambert wrote a great piece on like the mariachis and the rent strike in Boyle Heights that a lot of people, and Mariachi Plaza that a lot of people don't know about. Caleb Horton from... he was at MTV News, great writer, did a piece on like the last pioneer chickens and, you know, and there's some like all the writers that, like a lot of the writers from POW that lived in LA contributed pieces. And, you know, I have a couple stories. I did a big Roy Choi interview, like a 10,000 word, you know, piece. We have a story on like this racist LAPD conspiracy against Malina Abdullah, who's a local leader of Black Lives Matter. And that was reported by a guy named Jason McGahan, who was a former staffer at the LA Weekly. Mm. And, you know, I don't know. I think we've seen kind of the ramifications of what happens when, like, you don't have strong local journalism. I mean, it just allows, like, developers and promoters and schemers to kind of just flourish, you know? So I'm not to say that, like, you know, it's just the kind of thing where it's, like, I don't know. I do think there is a need for, like, an alternative press. Like, I mean, the Daily can't. Like, you know, the New York Times is great. The Washington Post is great. The LA Times is great. They're vital for democracy. But that's, like, not the only thing. There's certain things I can't make, like, Drake jokes about, you know, the mayor and the LA Times, you know. Right.
What does Los Angeles mean to you?
It's, like, the oxygen I breathe. Like, we were doing things for The Land, you know, like, a capsule bio. And, like, you know, like, all the capsule bios. You're, like, have, like, some glib line about Los Angeles at the end. And I'm like, God, which glib line do I pick? You know, it's like my grandma went to like Fairfax High with like Herb Alpert, you know, like, and she's like, he's lying about his age. He's older. He's 93. You know what I mean? Like, and it's like, she's like, he's very handsome. You know, it's like stuff like that. Or like my grandma would, I mean, like my like great grandfather like bought the spot that was like, he bought the Hollywood Hotel for like a year, which is like on the Hollywood Highland where the Oscars are and like where the Kodak Theater is, and like sold it at a loss. And like, that's like why I'm doing this, other than like on a yacht somewhere where I'm like, God damn it, great grandfather, like haunting me in my dreams. Yeah. Like, don't talk about me on podcast, you fucking ungrateful bastard. You know, like just like weird, you know, like shit like that. So I mean, like, I don't know. It like, it's like going to like Lakers games when I was like a little kid, or like, you know, like Power 106 when I was like 10 years old, and like The Chronic, you know, like you're hearing Nothing But a G Thing for the first time. And like, you know, we talked about like kind of hip hop being our first language, but like being from LA to me was like my first language. And obviously there's a ton of transplants, but
how'd your grandparents get out here?
On my mom's side, I have no idea what brought them. I must have been like, I think like my grandfather lost a ton of money in the Depression and like came out here and like started fresh. And like they lived in Chicago. And then my dad's side, it was like kind of the 50s, kind of, I think, California dream. And then like they moved out to, they moved in basically what was South Central, and it was like kind of a changing neighborhood. And so like that's where my dad went to junior high school. And like, you know, and then, yeah. And then I'm here, and I thought about leaving when I was young. You know, I was like kind of wanted to go to New York or San Francisco. And then both cities just became so expensive. I had no...
Well, like, what did you want to do in either of those cities? Like, I mean, like, you know, you're growing up around, you know, a cultural hub in Los Angeles. And what were you seeking out in, like, a San Francisco or New York?
San Francisco, I probably was chasing the dream of the Beat Generation, like, 50 years later. Like, I'm, like, kind of, like, a sentimental person at heart. So I always... Like, I did, like, my most personal story, at least to me. Like, I mean, I've written things that are probably more, like, personally revealing, but... was about the Beat Generation, like for the Washington Post. I did like 2 years ago, and like my editor, David Malitz, is amazing. And it was just like, yeah, you can write 12,000 words about the Beat Generation. I was, you know what I mean? It was like, I was like, I think it'll be 7, like in like 12,000 words. And he's like, we'll figure out how to put it in. Which is like, I mean, those are, you know.
How much heroin did you have to do for the piece?
Less than you'd think, but more than I would have liked. You know? So needless to say, my veins are done. yeah, no, but it's cool because like in San Francisco, like that, it was kind of, you know, going up there and reporting it, it's like, that's the tragedy of the Bay is, I mean, one of the most, I think, like culturally rich places in the world probably ever. And, you know, I was going to these, you know, nonagenarian, octogenarians apartments, and then like, you know, you can just tell, like, you know, one of them is like, my landlord's just waiting for me to die. They're going to get $5,000 a month for this place, you know? Yeah. And they're just like these like treasure troves of history and like books and knowledge. And I just really wanted to kind of, I mean, that was kind of what made me want to write was the Beats. I mean, like, I had my own thing, but that was the first like literature kind of thing where I was like, oh, like you can do that, you know? And,
Who was the first person that told you you were a good writer? Like, even when you were like growing up?
I don't know. Honestly, I wasn't, I didn't think I'd ever be a writer. I just was like a compulsive reader, and I never really did. I always thought that I could write, kind of like, I don't know, it's like, I always like would interview rappers and they'd be like, I don't know, I always thought I could rap. And then one day, even like most of the time, it's not like that's true, you know, unless like Blue, it's like something like Blueface, basically. Yeah, like, yeah, I just started rapping 12 months ago. Like, no, but like, you know, and then I didn't think that it was possible to be a writer, you know, because my dad's like a very like no nonsense like lawyer, and he's like, you are going to go to law school. And I was like a baseball player, so I thought like, I played baseball and basketball, and like I played baseball in college, and I thought like, oh, I'll just,
wait,
like,
you did all these sports and you're Jewish?
yeah. I once upon a time could dunk. I dunked like 6 months ago, and I was like, that's it. Yeah, that's, it's never happening. But it was like one of those things where I felt like rookie of the year, where, yeah, I'm like, oh, yeah, like, I'm, yeah, like, there's must be magic today, and, you know. And yeah, it'll never happen again. But like, luckily, my friend Martin Douglas is a writer, like, saw it happen. I was like, tell the internet. Tell the internet.
So you're a voracious reader. Did you read Susan Orlean's book, The Library Book, recently?
Oh, no, is it good?
Amazing. Yeah, it's about the fire. Well, ostensibly about the fire that burned down the LA library.
And, right. I've heard about it.
But it's
really
so much
good.
More than that. It's about librarians. It's about libraries. It's about authors. It's about those who use the library for shelter.
Yeah.
Those who use it for class. It's really like a much bigger story about like modern culture.
That's cool.
And it's just an amazing read, and should you have the chance to,
that's cool. No, I like, I lived in libraries. That was like my thing. Like, every, you know, I would go I'd either be like playing sports or like they would drop, my parents would drop me off at the library. Like my mom would drop me off and like for 8 hours later and like, you know, they'd have like a war. And I would like, must have been like obsessive compulsive, which I probably still am in some degree. But, you know, I'd be like, I must have the most books read. And like, you know, you get like these bookmobiles and up. And, you know, at the library, like my elementary school, like there was this really cool librarian and she would just like let me check out like 10 books at a time where other kids would get two or three. And like, I must have like mowed down. I was like really into sports books and stuff. And like,
Matt Christopher.
Yeah. I wanted to write a profile and he's dead. Like I was like he's got but like yeah
you can
yeah,
still
write
like a dead profile
totally no it'd yeah. Be, yeah like who is like the secret inner life of Matt Christopher. Like you maybe don't want to know though. It turns out Matt Christopher was a pedophile. You're like, oh no, like that's the real blood on my hands to discover that, you know. It's like not for the worst time. It's like Michael Jackson, right? You're like, I mean, we've known that for a while, but sure. I mean, that was for me for music. My family was like, might as well have been like an Amish house. They were like, I mean, there were books, but only the books that I would be like, can you get me books? And there were like no movies. There were no music. So like my house, like my parents, like just so like I had one album and it was Michael Jackson Thriller and it was like on vinyl and that was the only thing I had until like Bad came out. And then I was like, okay, I need Bad now. And then, and that was it. So Michael Jackson to me was like literally like my like total sum of like what music was, which I mean in hindsight was like pretty good. Like if you have like one album,
nine songs or something like that.
Yeah,
like it's a short album, that's the only nine songs that you had in your life
until I was about like 8 years old. Yeah, totally.
And but that like could have been like any like it could have been like. You could have been listening to like INXS for, you know, a decade or whatever.
Yeah, that's why I got my hair. Everything is about Michael Hutchence, RIP. Like, I said that. Like, I think I heard like INXS was in. I was like, actually, INXS kind of slaps. In hindsight, it's not reevaluate.
So baseball was super important to you.
Yeah, I love that. Was like
big Dodgers fan?
No, actually, it's I don't talk about it publicly because I don't want to insult. Like, but I actually hate the Dodgers.
Why?
Oh. Because my dad is a I love him, but he's like kind of a like a contrarian is the best way I can put it.
Yeah.
So my dad, which is like insane. This is a horrible thing to say out loud. Like it's like, but he like likes like the San Francisco Giants, who are a good franchise. I like the Giants, but he liked the Boston Celtics in the '80s. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, what possessed? And I was always a Lakers fan. Like, I mean, like my dad, like I have no idea why, but like, we never like would go to, we didn't go to games that much, you know, because it's like a fortune. But it's back when they played at the Forum, and for like some reason, maybe he had a friend or something that like gave him a discount. But we like got like, I must have been 5 or 6 years old, it was like right at the height of Showtime, you know, and we had these amazing seats. I've never had such good seats other than like when I was coming up for press. And so I was just like the Lakers. I'm like Magic Johnson, like James Worthy. And then like I went to the Magic Johnson basketball camp when I was like 10 and Magic Johnson yelled at me.
What?
And I was like, well, I probably deserved it. It's kind of a jerky game. But it was like one of those moments where I'm like, oh, Magic Johnson's yelling at you.
Yeah, wait, what did he yell at you
for? It was like picture day, right? So like poor Magic, in hindsight, like poor Magic Johnson like has to like deal with like 500 smiling idiot children.
Right.
Like, and like put like smile and like, you know, take a knee and like, God, that must be horrible. But like it was like,
and you were like, my dad likes the Celtics.
Yeah. You're like, actually Robert Parrish could kick your ass. You know, it's like,
and now he owns the Dodgers and you hate the Dodgers. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, it makes sense.
I'm a Cincinnati Reds fan though, actually.
What? How in the world?
That was my T-ball team. I was like,
no, it wasn't.
It was my T-ball team. Eric Davis was like my favorite player.
Wow. Yeah, but you weren't on the Cincinnati Reds. You were just like on the LA Reds or something.
I wasn't a bright child, Jeff. Yeah. Like, I didn't know. My dad's name is Walt Weiss. So, like, for 6 months,
you thought he played shortstop?
Yeah. I was like, okay, that makes sense. That's why you're good at baseball, your dad. But, like, I was like, oh, maybe. I don't know. Like, I don't know.
That's
baseball,
why you're on the road a lot.
Yeah.
Like, you really were dumb.
81
that's why dad
games
never
here
comes home.
Yeah. It's like, no.
My dad looks different on TV.
Yeah, I was like, okay, all right. Yeah, it was very odd. And I was like, congratulations on winning Rookie of the Year. And the Magic Johnson story, basically, it was like some dumb picture day thing. And like, you're just like walking around the back, and of course, like I was like a dumb lefty, and like I walked right in front of the picture, and Matt Johnson's like, "What are you doing, kid?" I'm like, "Oh no,
I know, yeah.
Your hero's kid hates you," which was wise on his part.
Yeah. You end up, you know, a Cincinnati Reds fan.
Yeah.
Eric Davis though ended up playing for the Dodgers, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. Which was hard. Yeah. No, it was like now. I kind of have more of a, I can't root for the Dodgers. It's really difficult. Like, I don't want to root against them because, like, so many people, like, in LA, like, love the Dodgers. So many people, like, I love the Dodgers. But it's like, I think I've been brainwashed. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. It's like, and you're trying to fight this lock in your brain, but I can't just like the Dodgers. Like, it was really hard when they played Boston, though.
Yeah.
Because that was just like, how do I root for
it? Right.
Like, this is just, you know, it's like, I don't know, Boston. Like, no offense, but.
Yeah, but some offense.
But honestly,
no cap, but some cap.
A modest amount of cap.
Yeah,
totally.
Do you end up going to college?
Yeah, I went to Occidental College, like out here, mm-hmm. Which was like now famous because Barack went there. But yeah, I thought about.
Did you just call him Barack?
Barack Obama.
Yeah. No, I know who Barack.
Have you heard of him?
Yeah, it just feels like, you know, I never.
He's my best friend.
Yeah.
Just name dropping casually. Yeah, me and Big B. You know,
you guys smoked weed together.
Yeah, yeah. We did. We did.
Barry? Yeah,
I gave him that straw hat. You know, just, he looked better in it than I did.
What made you want to go to Occidental?
They were like, I wanted to play baseball in college, and I thought I would go there and transfer like a D1 after 2 years because you're younger than most of the kids my age, and like I was young for my grade, and I thought like, okay, well, you go to a small school, you start as a freshman, and transfer to either junior college after your freshman year, and I almost did. But I just like was like, eh.
What position?
I was a first baseman and a pitcher. Mm-hmm. So I was a lefty.
You're lefty,
so,
yeah.
So I mean, I like always had arm problems, but I was a starting pitcher my sophomore year, and I was like, I started all 3 years, and we ended up having a walkout my junior year because like obviously like sedition is in my blood. So like I was like, you know what I mean? Like God, this. But it was like we ended up having this team walkout. It was like a pretty crazy experience. Like a guy on my baseball team died in a hazing accident.
Jesus.
He was in a fraternity and I had pledged. I didn't know what a fraternity was. Like I literally had no fucking clue. I was like, oh yeah. It's like, I thought it was like an Elks club or something. Not like this sadomasochistic like bro.
Yeah. Know, elephant walking. Yeah.
Totally. Like, yeah. And I showed up. I was like, what the fuck? You know, but I pledged because all these guys were my baseball team. And then I de-pledged before I became active. But I went through most of like the hazing that I ditched a lot of the hazing. But like,
smart. Yeah. People love to just do the hazing and then not get any of the actual rewards of it. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. There were no rewards actually. Yeah. No, it was, they were just, so they ended up basically, I tried to get all these kids not to do it, but they ended up doing it anyways because, like, you know, you kind of have to experience it for yourself. And tragically, my junior year, a guy on my baseball team, who's this really brilliant, like, baseball player, like, freshman, pitched, played short. It's about to be, like, a starting shortstop. And, you know, our backup left fielder, also a freshman, fell asleep at the wheel coming home from Vegas. The car, he died. One of my friends, my like, got, like, brain damage, was, like, in the hospital for like 8 months. Another guy was paralyzed for a year. Like, and you know, this obviously this kid, Greg Davis, died. And and then that kind of started me on my path to writing because I kind of dabbled with it. And I basically started after that, like we had a walkout of the baseball team like a month later. And it, kind of the void in my life that baseball had always, you know, it was immediately occupied by writing. And I started like working on a book that summer about it. And it was one of those things I worked on for like 4 years, finished it, like, and I put it in a drawer. And it's sort of at some point, maybe like I would love to like publish it just because, you know,
it's still in the drawer.
It's in the drawer over there. It's like a young adult book. Like I didn't know that, like, you know, when you're writing a book, when you're like 21 years old, like you probably only are going to write young adult fiction.
Sure. Yeah.
And I just like, you know, I had like bigger literary aspirations, so I didn't want to like write a YA book. In hindsight, like I probably should have just like been like okay with being a YA book, but I was kind of still probably am a little insufferable sometimes, but I was definitely like very insufferable then. So
you have a book that's like unfinished, but like where else do you channel writing from there?
That was the thing. I like got out of school and like I worked odd jobs for a couple years and like tried to
doing
figure
what?
It out. I mean, my first year out of school, I was like tutoring at this place called the Sylvan Learning Center. I mean, like
yeah.
I was writing papers for this woman that like was trying to get a master's at Cal State LA. I like ghostwriting her papers. I was like grading papers for my like cousin's it's funny for like my cousin's high school. So like I got a job randomly. He went to MiraCosta High School in the South Bay, and like they would just give me my cousin's like they're like, okay, you're gonna grade papers for the district, which is also an insane thing that you're like they didn't know me. They're just like, oh, you're just some random college kid. Like, just you want to grade papers like that you don't know anything about? Like, that's horrible. Like, what is? And they would give me my cousin's papers. So like I would just give my cousin straight A's, like, but like he'd be like really sloppy and like write him notes, like, you know, it's like, very weird. I was doing that, and then I ended up getting a job at, like as a business reporter for like a year and a half, which kind of like taught me how to be like a real reporter. And
yeah, where was that?
It was in the Valley. It was like Woodland Hills. Like, so I would like, that was kind of what I feel it's important to have like a day job at some point to just like know that you're not capable of it. I mean, I'd have to wear a suit and tie, and like I must have been like 22 or 23 at the time. And I wanted to kill myself. Like, I would just, you know, it was...
Business reporting was not your passion?
Yeah. But, like, you know, in hindsight, it was really valuable for me. I remember my editors would be like, I would ask them, how do I transcribe an interview over the phone? They're like, you don't, you type really fast. So I just learned to type really fast. So I just now like type all my interviews on the phone. I've never, no one's ever.
You don't use a recorder?
I mean, I do when I do it in person, but yeah, over the phone, I just type it. And like stuff like that, or, you know, just like little things where I'll never forget this one woman who like, we're like, it was a really belligerent relationship. She's like significantly older and she probably thought I was like just a cocky idiot kid, which I was. And she would be like, well, what do you do in an interview when someone's dodging your question? And I was like, I don't know. She's like, you just keep on asking in different ways until they eventually ask. You know what I mean? It's like stuff like that where I'm like, oh, that's a good thing. And then basically I was reading all these blogs, you know, and around 05 I started Fashion the Wise, and that was initially it was just sort of like it was like a knockoff of like, do you guys ever read like the Blag blog?
Yeah, of course. Alex Blag.
I thought like Alex Blag was, I mean, he is hilarious, and yeah. I loved that blog and I thought it was so funny, so I would write these like horrible imitation knockoffs of it. And like then I was like going to a bunch of concerts at the time, and obviously like hip hop was like my first musical love. Like I didn't even know anything but hip hop really existed other than like The Doors,
right,
and like Jimi Hendrix until I was like 23. And it was just like straight rap, you know. And even then, it was like only like I had a breakup that I was like, I guess Bob Dylan makes sense to me. You know, wow. It's like, wow, Spanish boots of Spanish leather. Like, you're really healing my soul, Bob. And also a friend, close friend.
Bob and Bob and Brock.
Yeah. Hanging out on the links all day. And just
did you start on like Blogspot or something?
Yeah, it was a Blogspot. Yeah. And I, you know, I loved like Aquarium Drunkard, and Girl vs. Bear was like super popping at the time. And Ian Cohn had this blog called Sexy Results. Did you ever read that?
No.
It was really good. You know, Joey, he had like the Straight Banging blog in New York.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I'd read that. And I was like,
and then he was a lawyer.
Yeah, you know,
Joey Littman.
Yeah. He did what my family would have loved for me to have done.
So, you know, you're doing a blog spot,
making big money.
Sure. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Racks upon racks.
Too much money.
Yeah. I didn't know what to do with it. But did you had a drug traffic?
Were you driven to build an audience, or was it something where you're like, I'll put it out there and eventually people will find me?
Well, I was writing this book at the time, so I really thought, like, at first I was like, well, you should. I liked the community of the blogs. I also like was like, well, I guess you should have like some kind of digital presence, because it was before social media. Like, you couldn't just be funny on Twitter, or you couldn't have a Tumblr or whatever. You had to have a blog. So I was like, okay, well, that's cool. Someone once said something really good. He's like, she was like, the thing about blogs where they allowed you to have a job in journalism where your parents didn't know someone, you know, and I didn't have the money to go to journalism school. No one was going to pay. I mean, I could have taken debt, but all the journalists I knew that were like, they were just like, don't go to journalism school. Like, so I was like, all right, like the guy, this guy, Bob Sipchin, like
Bob
Sipchin. At Occidental, where Barack went. He like, my friends actually, I was like such an idiot. Like, I decided to take the Moby Dick class, and like they took the journalism class, but they're like, he says don't go to journalism school. I was like, all right, secondhand, I got it. So then I just started doing it. And then like I had some money saved up, and I really wanted to finish my book, and I was like, okay, I'm just gonna like quit this business journal job, just work on my book for, I can have like 6 months, like before, like if I do enough like small work, like I can like hold out, and if I can't get into the Times or the like Weekly, then like maybe I shouldn't do this. And like 6 months later, like I got into the Times, I think, first. And it was, yeah, I remember there was a guy named Kevin Bronson, who great guy, he was like he still has this website called Buzz Bands that like covers local bands in LA. But you know, he gave me a chance because like, it was funny because he was like, played an adult league baseball team. He's like, I hear you're a pretty good baseball player. I'm like, I used to be, but like, I'm doing my own thing now. I'm like trying to be a writer. And he's like, well, maybe you should play my baseball team. I'll give you a shot, you know, writing. And I was like, fair. So yeah. I played in his baseball team for 2 years and like 2 summers, and he gave me a shot at the LA Times. And like,
how'd you do, by the way?
It was pretty good.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah. Like, I'd always hit like 360. Oh. And like, but
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, that's, yeah. I don't, or like three, between 330 and 360, I'd always hit, but I never like.
I did pretty good. Yeah, I was only one of the best batting averages.
No, but it's like adult league. It's, you know, it should be hitting like 520.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
It's like, or it's like in college, you know what I mean? Like, I always hit above 300, but it's like not like, it's not like major league pitching. You should be hitting like 400. So right. My best thing was like a guy that was a first round draft pick. I got a couple hits off and one in a college game. It was like the closest I came.
That's dope.
It was like this guy Jason Hirsch, who played at Cal Lutheran, was in our league, and yeah. I don't know. Sparky Anderson came to the games, and we're like, Sparky's here.
Wow.
I was the guy that like scouts would come to the games, and they'd be like, yeah, that guy's like good, like, you know, and then like they're like, what's wrong with him? And it's like, oh, he's like has a 10-cent brain, you know, like, yeah, he was like a writer's brain in a baseball.
Were you like body. Sparky Anderson, like Tigers, okay, but Sparky Anderson, Cincinnati Reds?
Yeah, I was like, yeah, legit, yeah, big red machine, Sparky Anderson, yeah.
Did you exchange blog roll requests with everybody?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, I was about like, I mean, I remember like that was like a big deal, right?
You guys, it was everything.
Blog roll, yeah. Like, whoa. Do you remember the site whatevs.org?
Yes.
Like, so, he, like, this guy, Mark Graham, that really nice guy. And, like, mm-hmm. I remember he had, like, a section where he was ranked. And it was, like, the A-list. And it was, like, more buzz than you. And, like, he put me in more buzz than you. And I was, like, I made it.
Yeah,
this
is
it. Yeah. All right. Smooth sailing from here on out. And it was.
Yeah.
What were you writing about on your site?
It started out just, like, a mixture of, like, old music, me complaining about how much I hated LA at the time, because it was like the height of like the LA like
hipster
Hollywood hip, yeah, it was like, yeah, American Apparel, like mm-hmm. CineSpace Tuesday nights, like,
but
like,
you were also reading like Gawker and Defamer, yeah, and like Alex Blagg and like, totally, all the, like, I'm sure Gabe Delahaye. And did you have that like voice too where you were just like, you're so disaffected?
I was trying to, yeah, like, yeah. I would definitely love Defamer, like I love Mark Lasane's stuff, and I was like trying to write, they would just make fun of the people from Misshapes,
yeah, yeah.
I thought that was the funniest thing I'd ever seen in my life,
like, but hipster or homeless or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, that was a dark time for LA too, I thought. Like, it just didn't have the, you know, like what LA had became in the ensuing years. I'd go out and I was like, oh, am I going to a Cobra Snake party? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was just like weird. Like,
maybe.
And then, like,
yeah.
No, and then of course, well, everyone has one Cobra Snake story. Yeah, yeah, like, you have to have one.
What is yours?
My one is I was reporting a story.
You walked in front of his camera and Magic Johnson yelled at you.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That's exactly it. And no, I was, this must have been, what, 2011, I think, 2010, 2011, and Spin, like when it was still a print thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it was the first or second thing there, but they're like, it was this crazy story. It was, it came out pretty well. I'm pretty still happy about it, but they're like, we don't know what the scene is. Like, there was a place called Freak City on Hollywood Boulevard. So, like, for a while, actually, like, it was like a really cool, it almost was like Pleasure Island, but like, but like, it was like 80s graffiti hip hop. Uh-huh. It was like a very weird thing. Like, it was right on Hollywood Boulevard, and you had to enter through an alley. And for some reason, the cops like didn't shut it down for like 2 years. And like, it would just go to like 5 a.m. And they'd have like Egyptian Lover played there once. Wow. And Little Bass God played there once. Like, it was like, they would just let you do whatever. And they would like, you know, serve you like drinks and thimbles. And so there was a scene that kind of cropped up around it. And there was this girl named like Lauren Avery, who's like, she's like, I think an Instagram thing now, but like, she was like going under the name Meg Ryan. That was like, and they're like, and they were convinced that Lauren Avery was the heir to the Avery Dennison paper fortune or whatever, which was totally wrong. Like, it was like, no, like, which I, until like 3 weeks of reporting, then she's like, why would they think that? She's like, that's not true. Yeah. And I was like, I'm a great reporter. And so I remember like in the course of reporting, I think I ended up going to like a party at some like rich guy's house in the hills. And this girl calls up the Cobra Snake to pick us up. I'm like, what? And like, my car was in the bottom of the hill. So like, but the Cobra Snake somehow picks us up wearing just tidy whiteys.
Sure.
Like, of course.
Yeah.
Like,
well, and a mustache.
Yeah, and a mustache. And like, he's like hurtling down the hill. Like, I think of like a Range Rover, like in the Hollywood Hills. The Cobra Snake's in his tidy whiteys. And I'm just like, oh my God. This is like the worst LA story ever. Like, put me out of my misery. Yeah. Story. Yeah. I never figured out what the story was, but it ended up in print. Like, the whole thing made no sense. And then the place got shut down. Like,
so what were you listening to at that point?
Which point?
Like, in that early blog sort of point.
The long answer, right, is that I came up on like, you know, the 90s West Coast stuff.
Sure.
Obviously, I loved the East Coast stuff, like Gangstar, Wu-Tang, Tribe, J8, all that stuff. Like, yeah. And I was the biggest Jay-Z fan. Like, I didn't understand, because I never was super into the Underground Wars, where I was like, oh, I'm not supposed to like Jay-Z because he's popular. Like, we were just like, I heard Brooklyn's Finest, and I was like, well, that's the best song I've ever heard in my life. Like, you know, and then like, you know, when college, like, obviously it was the height of like the Raucous and like Def Jux and like post Fondulum. And so I got into that, you know, and I got into Doom. And then like, I don't know, there was those periods where like I was like trying to find like underground, you know what I mean? Like Murs had a couple albums I liked, like I forget, like, you know, Black Milk was doing stuff, but it wasn't like now, or even like, I feel like around 2010 it kind of kickstarted again. Like, I feel like that was a real low ebb. I was listening to a lot of indie rock at the time, because that was like really the thing that was like, especially around here, like, you know, I was like, I guess I'm in Silver, like, I don't even know what. Like, we're talking about, like, L.A. rap, right? Yeah. Where it's, like, you know, Bishop Lamont was trying to get his album. No one, there was just the game. It was, like, no one could get their album put out. Like, Russell Malone was trying to, you know, and, like, Nipsey was in label Purgatory just starting.
Yep.
Kent, TDE was, like, before TDE, before Odd Future. You know, I remember I did a cover story for the Weekly, right? And this was, I think this was one of my first big ones, too. And it was, like, the new faces of L.A. rap, right? I just started writing for them, and it was, like, Blue.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I mean, I liked Blue a lot, you know, but Blue obviously like got signed to Warner Brothers and basically got shelved for a while. Pac Div got shelved.
This is before Dom Kennedy.
Yeah, before Dom Kennedy.
Yeah.
Bishop Lamont got shelved, and the Nux, who put out one album, and then, like, they got no promo, and, you know, they were, like, kind of, like... So there, I was listening to, like, a lot of, like, you know, like, indie rock stuff for a couple years, because I just, you know, I'd still listen to rap, but, I mean, I don't know, like, Wolf Parade. I really loved Wolf Parade. Like,
yeah.
I loved this band Islands. You ever listen to them? Like,
yep.
You know, like, the first Arcade Fire was, I thought that was great. I thought Interpol, those first album was great. I mean, that was kind of, were you guys, like, did you guys ever, like, have, like, an indie rock year or two?
Yeah. I mean, I listened to, like, Yeasayer, Passion Pit, like, but that's probably as far as it.
Yeah.
Like, went.
Yeah. No, I was like, yeah, like, yeah.
Vampire
like,
Weekend.
Yeah. Dunyan. Like, you ever the Swedish band Dunyan? I was like super obsessed with. I liked like the first Beirut album. I was like really into it for like a year or two just because I was like kind of like sad like at the time too. And like, I don't know, rap. I think it like took a while to figure out what the sound was, you know, for like what underground music even was, right? Like, I remember when Bronson came out, that seemed like kind of new for like, oh, this is or Rock Marciano, obviously. I mean, I feel like Rock, when he came out with Mark Berg, like changed everything for New York rap, because you're like, I mean, if you really think about it, like whether it's like Griselda or whether it's like those kids like Mike or like all of it, I think kind of is post rock, you know?
Yeah, but how'd you as an Angeleno approach things? Because I feel like the city is so proud of their rap origins, yeah. And even in that down period where it was just the game around here, people were rooting for something bigger, right?
Yeah.
And when I think of you now, I do think of you as like the LA guy, right? And I feel like if there was anybody to sort of like push even the smallest guy out here, it would be you. Did you feel like you were like on the hunt for that guy?
Yeah, totally, all the time. I mean, and if I'm being honest with you, like a lot of those artists I liked, but like I didn't like, you know, really like love. Obviously, when Kendrick came out, that guy was like, okay, this is amazing. Like, and that was, I mean, I do believe in like a sense of regionalism where rap does sound differently no matter what city you're in. It's like when I'm in New York, it's like we're talking about rock. I'm like, right. Oh, if it's snowing, like, and I hear snow, like, done.
Yeah.
You know, or on the 90s stuff, it sounds perfect. I remember Cannibal Ox, like that sound, that's like a perfect Subway album. But LA, like, you know, it was like a low ebb. And
Did you buy into J-Rock?
I liked that single with Wayne.
Yeah.
But I didn't like love it. Like, I liked J-Rock. There's a lot of stuff like I liked. Like, you know, like Nipsey I liked, but like I wasn't like, I think Nipsey's last album was the best thing he's ever done.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Agreed.
And, you know, it's like, right, this weird balance where you're like, I don't want to be like a cheerleader where it's like kind of corny where you're like, you know, and I feel like a lot of cities do that where they like they'll try to like sell you something and you're like, ugh. But then there's like also things where it's like, look, I don't really like a boogie.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, a boogie. But, yeah.
Like, I'm so LA. And
right. Yeah.
Clown me for that. Like you just, I was like, ugh. But like that's like the like thing in New York where Jay Critch.
The boogie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have our own boogie here. And then there's Big Boogie from Baltimore who I love. He has a sicko mode version. It's amazing.
Love Big Boogie.
I like Boogie here a boogie. Lot.
Mm-hmm. And then there's... Yeah.
Then there's just a Boogie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Boogie. And,
who has the number one album.
Yeah. I love Blue... I mean, so then, like, I just... Or, like, Jay Critch, right? Like, that doesn't, like, hit me. And, like, I wonder if,
well, you're
like,
also not a 20-year-old kid from Brooklyn.
Totally. Although, but, like, I love the stuff in L.A. where it's, like Blueface. I heard that, and I was like, this is my favorite shit ever. Draco, Greedo.
Well, let's also be honest, too. Like, Chicago. If you're from Chicago... Yeah. You love your Chicago artists, good, bad, or indifferent.
Like. Totally. Well, Chicago, I think, definitely is, like, very boosterish. But it's also, like, that makes sense because, like, it is kind of an often overlooked place. And it's, like, you know, and that's weird, right? Where it's, like, I like Keith, but, like, obviously I'm not going to relate to, like, Keith, like, a 16-year-old kid is going from the South
or
Side.
Or, like, David Drake.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. David Drake likes Chief Keef. David Drake loves Sosa.
Yeah.
I love David Drake. A great man. And has fancy footwork, as I told Chris Crack last night.
Yo,
David Drake, actually, low key good dancer.
Yeah.
I took him once to it.
We've seen him, David Drake dance like all the time.
Yeah. That's how you know you're real hip hop.
Hold up, Jeff. Wait a minute. We got some mugs to sell.
You interrupted yourself.
No, I interrupted Jeff Weiss.
Oh, it is confusing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't meet that many other Jeffs.
I don't think we've had any other Jeffs on the podcast.
That's not true. Jeff Sludge.
Oh, do we have any other Erics on the podcast?
Eric the Architect from, from Flatbush Zombies.
This is, all right, whatever, fine.
Yeah.
Any Dans on the podcast?
Dan Rosenthal has been on the
podcast. Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah. All right, so anyway.
We're selling mugs, we're selling t-shirts, and we're selling rhyme books. You can get our rhyme books signed or unsigned.
You have the option.
That is the option, and you can get them all at itsthereal.com/shop. The rhyme books were not previously on our website.
Now they are. Go get them. We have a limited amount. Rhyme book signed or unsigned.
Yeah, because a lot of people have been like, I want a rhyme book, but I don't know how to find it. And it's like, people cannot find it on Amazon.
Well, guess what, guys?
Guess what? It's on
itsthereal.com. /shop.
And while you're there,
yeah,
sign up for that newsletter that I've been talking about a little bit.
You've been talking about it.
I love talking about my newsletter.
You, Jeff.
Yeah.
And now back to Jeff.
So you're establishing your website, and what ultimately becomes the piece that you're like, oh, I can point to that and say, I found my voice.
I mean, I don't know. Like, there's like moments, right? Like, where I would say, like that piece on Jerkin was like that to me at that point was like, I was like a 5,000 word piece. I like reported it for a long time, but then I was like still kind of like trying to be Tom Wolfe. And then I did a story on DJ Quick that I really liked, you know, in like, it was a cover story. I think it was 2012. I think it's good to be like, the piece where I found my voice is the most recent piece, right? Like, so I did a piece for that's kind of come out on Pitchfork at some point. Maybe, hopefully it'll be out by the time this airs.
Before the paywall.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Hopefully before the paywall. And I went down to Baton Rouge. And like, I have a lot of love. I mean, I like love a lot of like certain cities. Like, I mean, Baton Rouge to me is like one of my favorite places. I was like, became in like the, I actually, when I came to New York, my friend Evan McGarvey, I never really like listened to Boosie extensively, and this must have been like 07 or something, and he just like put on like going through some things, and we were like getting drunk in his apartment, and I just was like, this is the best shit I've ever heard. And I got super into Boosie, and then so I covered his murder trial in Baton Rouge, and I've been going down there for like the last like 6 or 7 years, you know, every couple of years, and kind of interviewing all the rappers. And it's like a really dark and violent and kind of but like very powerful, the music down there, like, yeah. You know, and I've just had like all these like weird crazy experiences. So I went down there last year, and I wrote this, like, to the longest piece I've ever written. It's, like, over 20,000 words.
Wow.
Yeah, which, of course, my editors love. They're like, great, thanks.
They're like,
yeah.
We only asked for 1,000.
Yeah, like, 1,000. Like, we can change nothing.
A boogie.
Like, God, I'm like, yeah, totally. So it's, but it's, you know, it's crazy. It's, like, you know, on, like, YoungBoy and all these different rappers out there. And, like, you know, a lot of guns. And that's, like, one of the things that I kind of, like, lament about the state of, like, popular, well, I don't even, rap journalism in general, like, in the sense where it's, like, you know, you look at those old sources and you're like, well, they would have scene reports and they'd have like 4 or 5 like really in-depth stories a month. And, like, maybe the writing wasn't great, but like the facts that they were getting are great. And now it's like you look at it and you're like, I guess it's like a DJ Vlad interview or something on YouTube. I mean, you guys obviously do great work. But well, it's like,
but
there's
but
not...
isn't that the interesting thing? Like, people think that we're journalists and we don't consider ourselves journalists at all.
Not
because
yeah,
we don't,
yeah.
But that's, yeah. But that's like the funny thing is, right? Like, a lot of the best... I mean, if we're being honest, like, I'm like, DJ Vlad, like, gets a lot of, like, if you're looking for information about rappers, like, I think that's, like, why, one of the reasons why No Jumper got really popular is because, like, there was nothing on X. And, kid, like, whether we want something to exist, I mean, like, obviously the X situation is, like, a whole different topic, right? Where it's, like, you know, it's a troubled kid who was, like, a awful, you know, things
yeah.
that he's done.
Yeah.
The reality is, no matter what we as like, what, you know, whatever, if you, I don't even know if gatekeepers honestly exist at this point, really, unless you're like a radio DJ where you're putting them in front of millions of people. But, you know, as journalists, like, kids, regardless, the truth is kids wanted to know what X was like, whether,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
no matter, and like probably fueled also by like the abuse stuff, which is like sad. And it's a sad commentary. And that's a problem with America, right? And that's kind of what I talk about in the Baton Rouge piece. It's like, one of the problems with America is how much we love outlaws, right? We celebrate outlaws. Like, Bonnie and Clyde was, like, one of the most popular movies of the 60s. Easy Rider, again, this is 2 motorcycle outlaws. It's like, Billy the Kid, like, you know, he's
the Sopranos.
Fucking, yeah, he's a fucking yeah. mass murderer, Billy the Kid. I mean, the Ted Bundy thing is interesting, and I've been thinking a lot yeah. about that because in the context of Draco, the ruler, who's, like, I've been covering. I went to court last week to you know, and I watched Draco.
To cover that, not just because of your own, like, personal issues.
Well, yeah, totally. And I went to cover it, and it's tragic. You know, it's, like, these kids. It's his whole rap crew, the Sting Team. They have, like, chains around their waist. They're handcuffed behind, like, a metal cage in court. They're treating them like animals. It was, I mean, it was like racist. It was like disheartening. It's like, I mean, if you, I mean, I think anybody that spent any time dealing with anything in the criminal justice system or like realizes it's just like the most inhumane thing imaginable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm thinking about Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
Netflix is like, you know, there's a lot of other hot guys. And you're like, literally this $1 billion corporation is tweeting about the serial killer being hot and you're exploiting it. And like, what about the women that he murdered?
Yeah.
You know, like, no matter. And that to me is like, oh, but if it was a young black man who was an artist, like, we're just going to shackle him in chains, and like the racial element of it yeah. is like really disturbing.
But isn't like
and horrible.
One of the craziest things about the Ted Bundy thing, which is like not worth watching, I didn't think.
Yeah,
but one of the craziest things was he's arrested after 26 or so murders,
yeah.
women who he like would then like fuck in the woods or whatever,
yeah.
after killing them, without anything on him. He was able to like stand there and give his side of the story to television cameras.
Totally.
Yeah, alongside prosecutors. Like, he would just be like, okay, like, you've had your fun. You've tried to arrest me here. You're serving me with papers or whatever. Here's my side of the story.
Totally. Well, it's like Zach Fox, I think, has like a tweet right now. It's like really poignant. He's like, when a white man gets arrested of murdering his family, and it's like them on a jet ski.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like a family on a jet ski. And like, that's like the thing where it's like, and I watched that so much with the Boosie thing. That was like really like, not to say I didn't know before, but like, I'm at this trial and it's me and Boosie's whole family. You know, I'm like pretty much the only white person in the room. Like, Boosie's family, and like, I'm sitting with the family, and like, you know, it was heavy. You know, they're all like praying and holding hands, and they like kind of like took me in, and like, and you're in there, and then you have the police on the other side, mostly like white, or you know, they're just, there's like a sinister vibe coming from them. And you're in Baton Rouge, like, you're like, this is a place where it's like the darkest crime ever committed, you know, obviously slavery. I'll never forget, they bring in the person who was alleged to be Boosie's hitman. And like, they're still, you hear the chains rattling from the next room, and they're like, bring out Marlo Mike to testify. And you're like, he's shackled in chains and like this jumpsuit. And it's just like the way it was just so like all the sins of America, like still coming out in the forefront. And yeah. And that's still happening. I mean, in LA, that's the crazy thing. This Draco thing, I'm so passionate about it because it's like there, and they did it with Boosie, which was even a different instance of using his lyrics against him. And that's a whole different thing. I mean, I personally don't think you should ever use a rapper's lyrics against him, just as a rule. It's
right.
Just, agreed. It should be like, it's art. And like, even if there's a lot of similarities, it should just be off the record.
Agreed.
It cannot be put on the record.
Right. Yeah.
But Draco's case is particular galling. Like the Boosie case, you know, the prosecution's argument was that they had confiscated hard drives and he'd recorded two songs. One was called 187, one was called Body Bag, and it was within an hour after the murders. So like, that was there, and they had a bunch of like circumstantial evidence, but they were obviously like, they did not prove their case well enough. He should have been acquitted. Regardless of the logistics of it, he definitely should have been acquitted. And also the other thing you realize being in a case like that is like, whoever has the money for the best attorney is going to win. And, you know, and it's like so many innocent people have probably got convicted because they had the public defender. The Draco case, it's like, I don't know if you guys have listened to him. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like he's one of these artists where it's like, he reminds me a lot of Ghostface. Mm-hmm. It takes like a while to crack, you know, and then like all of a sudden it's all you want to listen to. Draco's lyrics are very slang heavy, like filled with double meaning and intricate syllables. But anyways, they're using these lyrics against him to try to paint him as like the sociopathic gang member. I mean, how many like rappers do we know that call themselves like, you know, their crew a gang? Like every rapper, yeah. You know what I mean? More or less. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're using these like in California, that obviously because the Bloods and Crips are from here. All you need to classify someone as a gang, I think, is like a hand sign, a logo, and three or more people. It's something like that. It's pretty close to that. And so it's like, they can call anyone a gang, and then all of a sudden there's enhancements so you can't get bail, mandatory sentencing comes in, and it's also just a way to like tarnish the person in the eyes of the jury, because it's like, you hear the word gang, we've dealt with 30 years of demonization where it's like the meaning of a, you know, different gangs are you know, it's just a complicated thing. But to have to watch it and kind of have to see it used against people in 2019 in LA, yep, kind of shocked me. I mean, the Bobby Shmurda thing though, right? It's very similar. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish that there were more people kind of covering these cases, because there's like hundreds of them. I have an article in the last Playboy about this, and there's like, there are, I think they told these people that this guy, Eric Nielsen, he does it for a living. You know, he's a professor at the University of Richmond and he tracks these court cases, but he said there's like 500 something cases in over the last like decade where they've used like random kids, like 19-year-old kids that just have a SoundCloud page, and they'll use their lyrics against him. The craziest actually was, there's this rapper named Tiny Dew. And he's from San Diego, right? And he was like, I think now he's like in his mid to late 30s. And I think he put out an album when he was like, I think it's like called No Safety or something, right? And it's like, he had used to be in like a San Diego sect of the Bloods, right? I think there were like a series of drive-by shootings in San Diego. And this guy, like at this point, like he'd used him to gangbanger, but he was like out of it and like was like literally laying tile for a living. And he gets arrested. And these prosecutors, there was an obscure law that had really never been used, but it was on the books. And they were trying to say that by rapping about the gang, he was promoting the gang, so he could be accused of any act of violence or any criminality that the gang did, which is insane to think about, right? So these guys committed drive-by. He happens to be in the gang rapping about it, so you're liable for committing the drive-by because you promoted it, right? Like, right. You made gangbanging a thing, which is crazy because literally we're talking about an album that has like 3,000 SoundCloud streams.
Right. Yeah, but also like that could be said about like any sort of journalist who covers it, because then you're promoting it, you know? I mean, like if you take anything to the nth degree, then totally. That just becomes like an insane sort of bar.
And he spent like 9 months in jail, like tons of money for legal fees, like couldn't That's get him a job. Like now if you Google him, Tiny Brandon Duncan, the first thing that comes up is like this court case where it's like, oh, you used to be in the Bloods, and it's like dude, like, he got out of it. Like, that, like, so much of gangs, and this is, like, that's another thing that's been interesting about, like, being able to report, and, like, that's why I'm a big believer in reporting, because, like, look, I grew up on the west side of LA, like, there were no gangs there, and, like, you knew of someone that, like, had gang backup or something, you know, but you didn't really know, like, I didn't know Bloods and Crips, right? Mm-hmm. And you have this misguided notion, right, of, like, in the popular press, right, like, they mythologize gangbangers, good and bad, mostly bad, right? Like, mostly it was demonizing, but, like, also, like, you know, your perception of gangbanging is like Boys in the Hood or Menace to Society and like NWA and like, you know, Above the whatever, you know, right. The Chronic, Doggy Style. And then you realize like so much of it is like, it's like family lineage, right? It's like a lot of gangbangers, especially now, like their mother was in it, their father was in it. Sometimes their grandfather was in it, you know? Like, I think Vince Staples was like telling me how like he was vague about it, but he's like, yeah, like my grandfather ended up starting like one of the big gangs in Compton. Like, he kind of like left it at that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not everybody in a gang is a killer. You know what I mean? Like, right. And it's like, I feel like there's plenty of people aren't. Like, a lot of it is just like, that's your neighborhood. Those are your like local ties. And
well, I mean, the Killer Mike just did a trigger warning on Netflix, and he talks about how for a lot of people, it's like a frat.
White people have Elks Clubs.
Yeah.
I'm sure the Masons did as much sinister shit, if not more. Like, right. But you know what I mean? No one's like tarring. I mean, they had an anti-Mason party in the 19th century. So.
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't really hear much anti-Mason sentiment these
right.
days.
Yeah.
But you're at the Kiwanis Club or whatever. Like, a lot of it is just like, I don't know. Like the Bloods literally started to protect themselves from Crips. And like, that's not to say that there aren't like killers or whatever. Yeah, but the reality is like more complicated,
and where it gets really dangerous is where it seeps into popular culture.
Totally.
So, you know, using blood talk and all that,
right?
Yeah. Which by the way becomes normalized.
Completely.
And then people who use it in their raps and don't live this life, it can then be used against them.
Totally.
For whatever sins have been happening.
Well, it's like when white people like use like Brazy or something,
right.
Compton or, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it's like, ugh.
Right.
Like, the reality is like, it's funny because I'm doing this piece on Snoop Dogg, which is like comically late, but as always.
Wait,
but,
is he like a fresh face?
yeah. I don't know if you've listened to this on Doggy Style, but pretty good.
Make sure to check it out.
Yeah. And, but it was like a source article from like 93. And I think it was like Dream Hampton or like she was taking it through the hood or whatever. And he's like, this is Bompton. Bompton obviously was like, wasn't even like Compton. It was like a section of Compton that was controlled by Bloods, right? Because like Compton, it's just crazy. Like, you know, certain high schools in a lot of these cities are like Compton High is a Crip high school. Like Compton Centennial is a Blood high school. Like if, you know, and like, it's just like stuff like that where I kind of get super. I mean, not to say that I'm like, because there's so much. I mean, I don't know anything when it comes to the grand perspective versus somebody that actually lived that, but which I think is important too. As like a white person in hip hop, I think part of it is like knowing your inherent limitations. Mm-hmm. I think it's like important to know like where, you know, like this is the line. Like, I mean, and I'm sure, you know, sometimes you accidentally like overstep it or whatever, but you know, it's like a conversation we're having before where it's like, I think it's like if you are contributing to the culture in hopefully a meaningful way and covering stories that people aren't, like, then, you know.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
Your site becomes Passion of the Weiss. Did that come from the movie or?
Yeah, it was like 2005, right? So it was like the movie had like kind of had been out for not that long. I was like, that's a dumb joke. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's funny. Like, continuing my great thing of like leading and getting kicked out. I was on my high school newspaper, got fired as a sports editor.
Damn.
Because like, long story.
Steroids?
Yeah. the juice was loose. And I ended up like having to spend like my like, and I told off the teacher like at one point. Like, I mean, I apologized to him a few years later, but I mean, like, really, like, just read him the riot act in front of the entire class, like, you know, 17 years old. I was like, no, it was like the scene in
Gutsy.
Like, it was like the scene in Half Baked, you know, where I'm like, fuck you,
yeah.
You're cool. Like,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And like, I just was like, nobody respects. It was really mean, honestly. But like, the truth is, he was an asshole to me at the time. And like, so I got thrown out of my high school journalism program, but I'd always like wanted a column in the newspaper, you know, I was like, what's a dumb pun name?
Yeah, sure.
And now, like, thank God, like, Passion of the Weiss, like, spells out POW. So, like, kind of, you know, if you take out the T. So I'm like, okay, that's good. I'm like, that's fine. I can call it POW now and like not have to make a Mel Gibson joke.
Yeah, I was just
like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
you're like,
yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Because who loves the Jews more than Mel Gibson? You know, in hindsight.
So who were you early on, you think? Who did you
Kendrick. I was like, I think I was like, I mean, I think maybe like two dope boys had like a MP3, but I was the first one to ever write about Kendrick in any kind of meaningful way.
And what appeals to you about him?
I was writing for the Times. And the Times is like, do you want to go to like a Mac 10 video shoot? Rick Ross and Lil Wayne are going to be there. It's in Malibu. I'm like, 100%. You know what I mean? Yeah, at the time, they're like, oh, it could be like $200. I'm like, sold. Like,
yeah.
I would
love to drive 4 hours over to Malibu.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? So I show up there and it's like this overcast day. Ross pulls up with like a blunt holder, not talking to anybody. Wayne comes out of like Escalade limo with like eight girls, his pants like halfway to his waist. Like Mac 10's kind of being like the mayor. And then like it's like a beach set, but it's a cold day. And so there's like girls in bikinis like playing volleyball, but it's like too cold. And, so, and there's like a high, they have like highlight canastas. It's like very weird. Like an ice cream truck, but it's fucking cold. Right. It's like, it's a real struggle rap video. And obviously like Mac, you know, it was like Mac 10. So Lil Wayne had the Cash Money ties with him. And like, you know, Mac 10's kind of just an OG. So like they were clearly kind of doing him a favor.
Yeah.
My friend Richie, he just points, he goes like this guy next to me, right? He was like, must have been like, I mean, Kendrick is not tall. He's like about 5'5", like an unassuming guy. He goes, that guy's going to be the next big rapper in LA. And you know, you've heard that so many times, right? Like everyone says that, right? I was like talking to these two girls that were there. I mean, like they could not have been less interested in me. You know what I mean?
They,
like
it was, they just wanted to play volleyball.
Yeah, they were there to play volleyball. They were just like girls watching. They weren't even like video girls. They were just like randomly there. And I was just like, all right, well, whatever. Like, I'm so bored on the set. And they were like totally, and then Kendrick like sidles up at some point and is like kind of like, he's like, yeah, you know, we're with Wayne, like blah, blah. You're like, I'm like, that's a very confident, and like they you know, he, my friend Richie is like, oh, K-Dot, this is Jeff, and Kendrick obviously could care less.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
he goes back talking to the girls. And then I go home and I like, I check out the song called Corrupted. It was like literally just Kendrick doing the Corrupt flow. And I was like, this is dope. And I like wrote a POW blog post.
Did that find his way to him?
I don't think so. I don't think like he had any, you know, it's weird. Like certain artists you'll write about like really early and they never realize it, and that's okay. Like, I don't think you're doing it for, like, it was cool. Like Greedo, you know, he, certain artists like love press. You know what I mean? Certain artists like are really like readers, and Kendrick doesn't read about himself.
Yeah.
At least what I've been told.
Well, he doesn't really read in general. Like I remember I interviewed him for Vibe and I was like, oh, like you definitely read books. And he was like, no, I don't.
Yeah. Like it's always weird when like that, like Aesop Rock, I remember like said he didn't read books and you're like, how do you even know those words if you don't read books? Kendrick, yeah. I mean, how was your... I just interviewed Kendrick recently. It was kind of like a... He gave me the post... He gave me, like, the post-game NFL interview. Mm-hmm. Like, where it's like, I'm just kind of giving... Like, he was nice, but he, like, wasn't, like... He wouldn't even admit that he was, like, making music now. I'm like, I assume you're making music.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He's like, no, I just got ideas. He's like, I'm writing a lot. I'm like, what are you writing? He's like, that's personal. I'm like,
yeah. All
right. He, we were down at Bonnaroo in 2012, and we knew Dave Free very well.
Yeah, he's
and
a great guy, Dave Free.
Yeah, amazing person.
Underrated producer, too.
Also great footwork.
Yeah. Really? Yeah. I can see that. Yeah,
but
that makes sense.
He,
no, I have no idea.
He hooked us up with an interview because we were working for Bonnaroo doing all these interviews with like Questlove, Alice Cooper, Feist.
Alice Cooper.
It was fun.
Alice Cooper is amazing.
It's a great interview.
Yeah. Did you ask him about Milwaukee?
Yeah. Of course you did.
Yeah,
of course you did.
Yeah,
but the joke with that was we let him to answer Milwaukee, but we're like, oh no, it's pronounced Kenosha.
The weird thing is I didn't realize until like 2 years ago Milwaukee isn't Algonquin for the good land. I was like, wait, what? my whole life has been...
Who did we... Oh, we interviewed somebody recently. Maybe it was like Harrison Remler.
He was throwing a concert in his backyard and I was like, oh, like Wainstock? And he was like, what's that? And I was like, all right.
Yeah, you know.
You know, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so we...
Rip Torn play.
Yeah, yeah. So we interviewed Kendrick down in Bonnaroo and we're talking about all these different things, including the fact that we had seen him perform at SOBs at a Charles Hamilton show, because it was really a J-Rock opening for Charles Hamilton, and Kendrick was in the crowd, and part of Charles Hamilton's like shtick then was to go in the crowd and like, who wants to freestyle against me? And so this kid who was part of J-Rock's camp was like, I will, and there's video of it, which is wild online now. So we brought it up to him and there was like no response, and then we joked around with him, no response, and then we asked him something about Drake and he walked out, and we were like, well, that's that. And then they wouldn't sign a release. And we were like, well, that guy has no sense of humor. And then like,
a year later, he was on SNL. And we're just like, oh.
Because what happened to, you know, to the guy that we found? So
Yeah. He, I mean, I interviewed him once in like, I feel like 2014, 15. And it was a really good interview. And like I mentioned the Corrupted thing of meeting him. Obviously, he didn't remember meeting me. But like the fact that I mentioned that like obscure song, like, and I wrote, you know, he... But that was good. This one wasn't. I mean, like, I think, like, just artists get to that level of fame where they're never going to give you there's no point for them to be revealing, right? Like, you know, it's like Drake. Like, I'm not a Drake fan, but, like, I can't imagine that, like, Drake is going to give a good interview ever again. Like, what is the gain from, you know, when you can get Maverick Carter and LeBron to do this, like, which was crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like, the way that was. I mean, like, there is a marketing genius about that. But that's what sucks, right? It's like, there's this catch-22, right, where... Right now, a good story would be like, go to Detroit with Sada Baby, right? And like, go around like the East Side because, like, and you write a story about Detroit because he's famous where people will know the article, But like most national editors, you know, are not going to be like, oh yes, that's like a good story, because they don't want like a Jay, a Wayne, a whatever, you know, whatever Big Sean even. Sure. You know, like, I mean, I've written like 3 Big Sean stories. People are like, just write about, but you know, and I'm like, all right, I'll take a check for a Q&A. But lovely guy, not much of an interview. But like a nice guy.
So like, what excites you then? Like, is it possible for you to try to write the profile on someone on Snoop's level, or is it?
Was cool. Like Snoop, I mean, and sometimes you meet someone and they're like Snoop was everything I'd hoped Snoop would be.
Yeah.
You know, you're just like, wow, you're Snoop. In every sense of the word. Like, it just like, and like, I actually talked to Andrew Barber about it, because I was like, I'd met like Snoop, but like not like really, like it was just like a quick, like whatever. And I never got to sit down with Snoop until recently. And that was always kind of like a bucket list. Do you guys get to do like a...
No, not yet.
But like,
Doing something. I've done something with him before, but yeah.
So that was always like I always wanted to sit down. And like Barbara was just like, man, just be yourself and talk about like old school LA rap and like the kind of early shit.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I started asking like Snoop like dumb questions. It was a variety. So I like wanted to, you know, he was promoting.
Tell me about Katy Perry's California Girls.
Right. I asked him that 4 times. Good answer. Yeah. It was like promoting like a Walk of Fame thing or something.
Right.
So I was like, I started asking about like, you know, the early 90s or whatever, like a switch went on and he gave me the best interview.
And it was a great piece.
Yeah, thank you.
It was a lot of fun, and it felt like him.
Yeah.
Is it impossible to get those done as compared to like a Greedo thing where it's just like, he's young, he wants that press right now.
Yeah, that's the time to do it, is before they've done like that many interviews. Like, I was thinking like now, like I wanted to do a Blueface piece, but I was like, I'm just going to let like other people do it. Like, it's fine. Like, I don't need to, you know, as I've gotten older, I kind of just like, well, I need to focus on like more, like the Baton Rouge piece to me is more something that like means something to me, or like, I'm, you know, a bigger piece on Draco, or like kind of doing something that has, hopefully can help in some like more way, rather than like, this is the new hot rapper that, you know, people need to check out. And that's like also why I have Passion the White still going, is because, I mean, the blog era is definitely dead.
That's
like
a wrap.
I mean, where are you going to find, like, I don't know, we just did a profile on like Pee Wee Longway, and it's like, yeah, like Noisy might do it, Fader might do it, you know, Pitchfork might do it, but there's not like blogs just doing that kind of thing anymore. Whereas I think when we were like younger, there definitely were.
Tell me about like, and I know you've spoken about this before when you started the Patreon for your site, but like how scary it is to be like, hey, you know, you like my site, now pay for it.
I hate that. I honestly, like, I hate having to do it like a Patreon. Like, I resisted it for the longest time because I was like, I don't like asking people for money. And it's like, but the reality is like the money we get from the Patreon isn't enough. Like, it should be double what it is now. And like, honestly, for like me to make a living off of it, it would need to be like 5 to 6 times what it is now. That sucks to me, because I would love to be able to like, it's not even about like me making a living off of it. It's like, these artists are small, like, and need to be covered before, like, you know, so like, it's like maybe you'd like to read, or like you're interested in the artist and you want to know something more. I always tell the writers, I was like, just add value to whatever you do. Don't be like, this song is dope. Like, you know what I mean? Because people are going to be on Twitter and just be like, 4 fire emojis, you know?
Yeah.
And, but like, give me meaning, give me history, give me context. Where does this fit in the broader history of this style of rap? You know, what is he doing with words or language or melodies that hasn't been done before? And maybe that's like pretentious, maybe that's esoteric, but at the same time, like, I don't know, I think that should exist, and there's just not many places for it. And I don't know how to make a Patreon bigger unless you like put it behind a paywall, right? Mm-hmm. Like, where it's like, I think with a podcast, it makes sense where you can be like, well, okay, we'll do 2 episodes a week or 1 episode a week, and the other one will be you have to pay for the Patreon to get the other one. But like for a blog.
Oh, maybe that's what we should do.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it's like a good way to do it. I was thinking about it, I was like, what do I do with my blog? Do I make, but like, I want people to be able to know about these artists, and you know, and it's like putting it behind a paywall is like, you know, do I make, you know, so I'm like, I've been doing Spotify playlists for the people that like, you know, are Patreon subscribers, but like, you know, giving away records. So like, I have a label POW, and like, I'll give away the records if they donate enough. But you know, you don't want to go to the point where I'm like, hang out with me. And like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't want, like, who would want to, you know, like, I was like, who'd want to pay that for that? But it's
have any labels ever approached you about like doing work for them, A&Ring?
Yeah. I've had those conversations. That's kind of why I started my own label. Cause it was just like, I just, not like it's like going to be like a huge like money making endeavor or anything, but just sort of like, I don't know. There's always artists that like I love, like basically I started the label because I don't know if you've listened to Chester Watson. He's an artist on the label. He's incredible. I honestly think he's like one of the greatest like most he actually is very popular. He just hasn't, you know, Rolling Stone did a piece on him. We dropped his last album. You know, Pitchfork's done stuff in the past, but he hasn't, like, he's, I think, in the process of becoming like a really big thing because he's absolutely incredible. But I wanted to get him a deal, I think, with a couple labels, go in name because I love these labels, but they didn't. He was about 17, 18 years old at the time, maybe even 16. And I was like, this kid's amazing. And nobody wanted to sign him. And I was just like, they're putting out these things, like nobody presses up on vinyl. Like, again, like it goes back to the tangible thing where it's like, I'm maybe romantic or nostalgic where I'm like, I think record, like you're in my apartment, so there's tons of books, there's tons of records. It's like, I love that shit. Like, otherwise it's going to get lost in the fucking digital shuffle, kind of, the abyss. So I don't know. I started with that. And like, I, you know, we put out a couple of records from the Outfit Texas, who was another group that like I've always loved. And I was like, why am I not on a label? Because there's so many groups that just are somewhere between the mainstream and the underground, you know, and like, and it's like, I think about, you know, like, you know, people ask like, what is the point of a label? I think in 2018 or 2019. And that's like a valid question. I think, I mean, part of it is obviously promotion, but I think part of it is just like being a part of, like, it's a family. Everything you do, I try to like make it like, I don't know, like as I've gotten older, like I realize more the importance of community, I guess, to go back to the land thing. That was like, that was what was being a journalist in LA for the last decade. You know, I saw how Low End Theory became like a real extended family, and Dame Funk's Funkmosphere was a thing, and the LA Weekly was a family. I mean, some of my closest friends in the entire world used to write for the LA Weekly. I mean, it really brought us together, you know. And I think it's important to have those kind of institutions where you know, because as like an antidote to kind of the digital like loneliness, because right, because like that means the thing, you like, don't, I mean, I know, sure, you guys feel like that, but sometimes it's just like you're fucking shouting into the void.
Yeah.
And when you have like, when you see someone in person where they're like, oh, I fuck with that, it's just such a different thing. I'm sure like when you meet like your fans or whatever, like they're like, that's like the best thing you can have when someone's like, oh, this, you know, and you see them in person. You
for sure.
Them.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it has like a more of a deeper meaning. So I've been trying to kind of, and the label, you know, it's too, it's like, the goal is to get these kids as big as possible to then go to a major label or whatever they want to do, or they don't even need a label and like, fine, like you're good. Like go fly.
So much like you're doing, you know, a Patreon for your website, you're also with the land building something where it's like, it takes money to operate,
yeah,
right?
It's so expensive.
But at the same time, you're also considering making it a nonprofit. So what's the blueprint to
how
this?
Does it work? You, yeah, of course. You know, I mean, and that is the question that we have been figuring it out. And
how tough is that?
It's so hard. It's so hard to do anything without like, you know, like without a Medici, you know, and like sometimes you get lucky and like, you know, like Red Bull did take out an ad in our magazine. Amoeba Records took out an ad. This place called The Lodge in Highland Park. Spaceland is a big promotion company in LA. They took out an ad. There were like several FSG Books took out two full page ads, which was like incredible. Like one was on Kobe, one was on the author Brian Phillips. That is kind of like, so basically we got money for this issue from a variety of places, right? So we didn't even know how much it cost, right? We're like, how many copies do we need? What kind of stock is it? Like, and to the very end, like, it's a nightmare. You're like, okay, well, 112 pages is this, but then you start laying out the paper and you're like, oh, this needs to be cut. This needs to be longer.
Yeah.
And it ended up being 144 pages, right? So then you have to figure out how much it costs. And it ended up costing like, it's like $23,000 just to print like 15,000 copies of a magazine. So then you're like, basically we cobbled it together from this magazine called Epic Magazine. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're amazing, like they're like Dan Fearman, who used to run Grantland.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Is one of the, and this guy Josh Behrman, who's a really distinguished journalist. Did you read the story in GQ about Tila Rock going to the Jewish old age home?
Yeah.
He wrote that story, and so they were just like, they have a nonprofit arm, and they gave us a decent amount of money. We had to do fundraisers. We've done a couple fundraisers, and that's kind of been a drag. Is I'm like hitting up artists and being like, can you please play our fundraiser? And of course, everyone has, you know, there's a lot of artists that are really cool about it, but you know, that it sucks to have to like ask people to do something for free. But then like none of the editors are really going to make money off of this. It's been like strictly for to build something that can last, so some fucking fascist can't buy it and like just destroy it and then deprive the city of what something that should be important. Like, I think all of us are kind of figuring out now, like, you know, we're of the age now where we have to build the institutions. We're old enough where we can, where we have a network where it can kind of grow, and we have to do it because, like, I mean, the truth is like previous generations have failed us. Like in every sense of the word, you know, whether it's like labels exploiting artists or whether it's, you know, you think about the independent labels of the 80s and 90s, they all consolidated. And now there's not that many. We have to build more like solid independent labels. We have to, you know, like what you guys do is like, you know, you're building your own like media company in ways, like, you know, Vice is like laying off people, you know, like BuzzFeed is laying off people. Like, we need maybe it's like not about building these behemoths, these conglomerates, but it's about building like little sustainable kind of like
Indie mom and pop shops.
Yeah, yeah, like that can, you know, maybe make a couple people a living rather than have to be because the thing about the Vice layoffs is so wild. You're like, they made $600 million last year. That's fucking nuts to think of like a company that makes $600 million as a media company, but somehow they're still laying off people. So I think it's with the land. So basically, we raised this money. I had to sell ads. I don't want to fucking sell. I hate that shit. But luckily, people in the, I think now we're at like this inflection point where people realize what matters, right? Like, I do. I think like if there is a silver lining to the Trump like chaos and just the most awful, you know, extinction level event that's happened, and one of them
since Busta Rhymes,
Rhymes, it's only 2 years left, but I think it's people do realize that like, okay, we do like the local news matters, like independent art like matters. We have to support like people because they are like, you know, there are these people kind of on the front lines fighting against the darkness, is kind of, not to say I am, but like there's a lot of people that are really doing it, and like myself included. I mean, the people that I work with, I like, not to take full credit, because honestly, like there are so many really, like we have an editorial team of six, and you know, of co-editors, and you know, and like honestly, like people like had to care. You know, we did. People had to like support that boycott. People had to make phone calls to shut them down. And like that to me was super inspiring, because who the fuck knows? Like I just honestly, like I started like tweeting one day because I was like, fuck these motherfuckers. Like, I'm going to dunk on them. I'm not going to let this happen. Like, you know, or at least I'm going to ruin their, like 50 was a big, you know, so I was like, oh, like 50. I'm just going to I'm going to Ja Rule them.
Front two rows.
And so this is my Fyre Fest.
When you look back at you as the kid who yelled on your high school teacher, or even the guy who led a walkout or was part of a walkout of your college baseball team, can you see your leadership capabilities in who you were back then?
I'm really good at leading a rebellion. I'm not really like good at like being like the mainstream kind of like I could never be like, I wouldn't, it's just not in my nature, but I'm good at like kind of calling bullshit when I see it and trying to like build like a, you know, we had like a strong like kind of a boycott type thing with the baseball team, like where most of the team did not return, and that required big sacrifices. So like, I don't know, I always, I guess, have been drawn to these kind of like these kind of figures that like, you know, the quote, like the famous Bob Dylan quote was like the honest men living outside the law. And I've never really, that's why I've like kind of like freelanced my whole career. I'm a big fan of team because like nothing happens without it. But at the same time, I'm probably like kind of difficult and kind of like want to be like have a big input. And I'm not interested in power for power's sake. Like I would love, like I love, you know, of course I like getting my like word in, like having like my vision implemented or whatever crazy harebrained scheme I have. But at the same time, I would never like, I don't know. I hated boss. You know what I mean? It's like I hated bosses. I hated people that like, I hated bullies. I guess that's really probably where like the thing is. I don't like being bullied. I don't like people that exploit. And I think like, I think that's like, we have to do that because I mean, I don't know, like you see it around like in this, everything in American life. I mean, capitalism is a system designed to exploit, not to be like super adbustersy, but like that's the reality. And you know, I think like we have to, I mean, that's what's cool about like what AOC's been doing is like, I love that she just like talk shit. Like, and like,
where's Mitch?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Where's Mitch? Like people need to do shit like that. And it's like, people can say like, I mean, there's always those people that are going to be like, there are people with LA Weekly thing. They're like, you're going a little too far. Like, you know what I mean? Like, don't call them Nazis. And you're like, well, they are, you know, more or less, but you need people that are like really, I love like people that do fight like that. I mean, because the Republicans fought like that. I mean, what was the Tea Party if not just a racist cabal of idiots that just kept on like that notion of the Overton window, I think is really true. Right. Yeah. Whereas, and I think like that was what AOC has done is really brilliantly. It was like, now all of a sudden the 70% tax rate on people making $10 million the Green New Deal is a conversation that like we have to have.
Yep.
And like, that's great. So I hope like, I don't know. I kind of see, I have an allegiance to kind of people that like kind of, like not outlaws, because like, you know, it's not about that. It's about like this subversiveness, because I do think if you don't have those people, like those are all the artists I was always drawn to, you know, that's maybe why I like liked rap so much in the first place, is because rap is like, that's like the coolest thing in the world to me. It was like, they're like, all right, you're like living in a South Bronx hell, like where the government has basically ignored you and abandoned you and like, you know, like built this expressway to like segregate the community. And they're like, all right, well, we're going to create the greatest artistic system.
Yeah.
Ever so created.
It's, and we know this well. It's one thing to, while you're putting your creativity out there and your heart, soul, and blood, sweat, and tears and all that on the line. And it's cool to know within yourself that you're leaving something good. But who are the people who have reached out to you and said, hey, we respect what you're doing and keep going?
It's like one of those big and small things. I remember when like the boycott first started, like Thundercat like was like super supportive. Wow. And like I love his music, and that was cool. Like Dame Funk, I'm like a, you know, like, but in terms of like the people from Epic, like, you know, giving us like money with no string. I remember we had a meeting with them right when they were like, I mean, they gave us, you know, like, we shouldn't get into the logistics, but they gave us a sizable money that like basically was the difference between us being like, how the fuck are we going to ever do this? Like, okay, now we only need to raise X amount of money. That seems like a manageable thing, because we were really adamant about paying our writers. I wanted to pay our photographers. And we were all, as the editors, were like, look, if we don't make any money, that's fine. Like, yeah, everyone else has to get paid first. But like them stepping up and being like, you know, and these are like, you know, the guy who ran Grantland and used to be an editor at GQ and he ran MTV News, Dan Fierman. Like,
yeah, yeah.
He's an incredible person. And they were just like, yeah, we believe in what you're doing, or what we think what you're doing is important. And honestly, like, not to like, because I'm obviously not like a corporate guy, but like the advertisers, like taking like our, like we sold like, you know, like $10,000 to $12,000 in ads. And like, that's off nothing. That's just off being like, okay, you know, you loud guy on Twitter, like,
yeah,
but like, we trust you because we believe, you know what I mean? The city needs this, you know? And I've been talking to like different labels and trying to explain, and I think everybody kind of gets it, because like, I would be like, remember that story I used to write for you on the LA Weekly? Well, that's not going to happen. And it's not about it's not happening for you, but like, you have to understand that it's not going to happen to the young artists, right? Because it's not about, and it's about the young writers. It's about like, I learned how to write because I was allowed to write weird in a place like the LA Weekly. So, and that's kind of with POW, the website, I try to do that too, to kind of teach people how to like, not teach people to write. I think it's sort of like Kurt Vonnegut had a great quote where he was like, you can't really teach anyone how to write. It's like correcting the flaws in someone's golf swing, you know? And I think a lot about that. And but it is about that, because it has, because I do get worried about like the future of literacy, and that's not being like kind of like, but like, I mean, that's the reality. It's like, like pivoting the video is not like, it's a joke euphemism, but like, that is the reality of it. Is like most things, like if you really look at even the most popular interviews are often like YouTube interviews. I remember when I was in Baton Rouge, like this guy's like, oh, you interview Kevin Gates? I was like, yeah, I've interviewed him like once or twice. And he's like, which one was it? I've seen all of them. You know?
Yeah.
And that was like, whoa, okay, that is a different mentality that I didn't even understand. So yeah, I think it's just about, I mean, long-winded answer, obviously, as they all are, but
yeah,
but it's, yeah, it's to well, have people like trust what you're gonna do. And I'm really proud of it, honestly. Like I want to, my goal is that, you know, I want to come out to New York, and like I want to go to like Chicago, and like wherever I go, like bring it. And just like, if someone wants to get a copy, I'll give it to you for free. It's free in LA. I mean, a lot of people did pre-orders like just to support, you know, if you were mailing it out if they don't live in LA, but a lot of people from LA were just like, yeah, we'll give you $20 because it's just kind of down for the cause. I want people to rebuild the Village Voice and not maybe call it the Village Voice, or rebuild Creative Loafing and not call it Creative Loafing. And like, I think print is important. I really would love to inspire other people to do this, and it's certainly like the most difficult thing I've ever done.
What is the hope for not only circulation, but also like how often you're going to try and put it out?
It's going to be 15,000 circulation.
And if people want to help, where can they go?
They can definitely buy a pre-order on the landmag.com. By the time this comes out, so yeah, we're going to try to do it quarterly. So hopefully we will have pre-orders for the second issue, but probably by the time this airs, it's coming out like early February, like February 10th, I think is like the actual release date. And then we're hoping to do at least two more issues this year, probably one in the summer and one at the end of the year, like kind of a wrap up. And then hopefully in 2020, I would love to make it a quarterly. I think that's like kind of what we're really pushing for. There's something cool about being a cult classic. And I think
a cult leader.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that's why there's Kool-Aid in that water.
Yeah.
You will drink it.
That's what I'm saying. When you talk about how you're going to make this a nonprofit, I'm like, you should make it a religious institution.
No. Like L. Ron Hubbard said, because that's where the money is.
Yeah. It's a noble cause that you're doing, but a realistic one. And I think that's the best part of it. And I hope that people really do contribute. And I hope that you get the chance to keep contributing to this, because I think it is a real thing where it's like, stuff does disappear.
Yeah.
And you're doing great work. Keep boycotting
LA Weekly. Still Boycott Weekly, yeah. It's like Seminal Media is a staff record label, is a motherfucking group.
That's right. You know? And congratulations on everything. And we're really looking forward to the
list. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Thanks everyone for listening to this new episode of A Waste of Time with It's The Real Jeff. People want to find out more about us, I'm Eric, you're Jeff, together. It's The Real. If you want to know more about this podcast, it's called A Waste of Time with It's the Real, if people want to find out more about what's going on in our universe, where can they go?
You can always go, and I mean always, 24/7, 365.
What?
Even on Christmas, wow. And especially on Arbor Day, you can always go to itsthereal.com/shop. Go get your itsthereal.com wares today.
All right.
We're talking about mugs. We're talking about rhyme books. We're talking about t-shirts.
Hell, anything else?
We've even got our newsletter on that website.
What?
Which is for free.
Well, definitely do that.
Yeah. If you sign up for the newsletter, we will send you a newsletter. That's the deal.
That's the guarantee.
Yeah.
It's the Real guarantee.
Also, you can find our podcast, old episodes and new ones, on iTunes or anywhere else, Spotify,
Castbox.
People fucking love Castbox. People love Castbox.
SoundCloud.
You can always go find old episodes and new ones, search for It's the Real, or A Waste of Time with It's the Real, or Two Jews and Two Black Dudes Review the Movies.
I suggest people do that. Catch up now, because we got new episodes on the way.
You can also go and find us on social media, at It's the Real on Twitter, at It's the Real on Facebook, at It's the Real on Instagram.
Jeff, I was listening to our friend Currency and our friend Wiz Khalifa. They have a new project called 2009, which I really enjoyed, and it reminded me that we have an awesome song with Currency and Smoke Dizza called
Sugar High. Yeah.
And I think you guys should go check that out, and if they want to, where can they do that?
You can always go to Spotify, search for Teddy Bear Fresh. That's our album.
Okay.
Yeah, go listen to it.
Well,
don't just listen to one song.
We're okay.
Come for one,
stay for
them all.
Jeff, we love to shout out everybody who has done something kind to us. You send us something like a ring light or a pair of pants.
I need jeans.
We will shout you out.
I'm willing to buy jeans.
But today,
send them to me.
Today, before we got any jeans or any lights,
yeah,
we said, hey, if you guys want to be shouted out because you signed up for the newsletter, let us know right now.
Yeah, first five to do it.
And we have more than five?
Yeah, we did like eight.
All right. The It's the Real 8.
Free the It's the Real 8. I want to shout out Saul Luna. I also want to shout out Alex Dixon, who might be the same person as AJ Dixon.
Don't know.
From Sioux City, South Dakota. I also want to shout out Dip Gang, our people here in New York. I want to shout out Kieran Oliver from Alberta, Canada.
Wow.
I want to shout out Victor from Providence. I want to shout out Aaron Francisco from Hayward, California. And Pablo Pandeli from Ontario, California. And also Justin Wagner. I did say I have the data on a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
About 50% of the people, I don't know where they're from. Justin Wagner, I don't know where you're from.
Damn. Well, guys.
Saul Luna, I don't know where you're from.
When you sign up for the thing...
No, it only asks for your name.
All right, well, we're going to figure it out.
All you have to do is just be born with a unique name that I can find you and assign a location to you.
And until that day, Jeff, now for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
We'll see you guys next week.